Welcome to Base by Base, the papercast that brings genomics to you wherever you are. Thanks for listening. And don't forget to follow and rate us in your podcast app. Imagine you have a factory manager inside your cells.
Okay.
And this manager is just incredibly powerful. I mean, they control the expression of like 15% of all your genes.
Which is a massive amount for one entity.
Right. They're in charge of cell division, metabolism, building cellular machinery, basically everything you need to keep the assembly line moving. But there's a problem.
It usually is.
Yeah. This manager is overzealous. Like, they completely refuse to stop the line. In fact, this single hyperactive factory manager is responsible for driving 70% of all human cancers.
Wow. 70%.
Yeah.
I mean, it is just a terrifying level of control for one single molecule to possess.
Exactly. And for decades, scientists have been trying to figure out how to, you know, fire this manager, or at least slow them down. But what if the physical break for this deadly cancer protein isn't some synthetic drug we have to invent in a lab? What if that break is actually controlled by a short-chain fatty acid? And not just any fatty acid, but one that can be produced right inside your own gut. Like, by the bacteria fermenting the dietary fiber you ate for breakfast?
I mean, that completely reframes how we think about the relationship between our diet, our microbiome, and really the most fundamental mechanisms of cellular growth.
It really does. So the mission of this deep dive is to explore this newly discovered cellular modification. We are going to look at exactly how it acts as a physical break on cancer growth, the really elegant science used to uncover it, and the devastating consequences of what happens when that break is removed.
And to do that, today we celebrate the work of Walu, Nicholas J. Wallbillage, and their incredible team at the Tulane University School of Medicine and Tulane Cancer Center, who have really advanced our understanding of oncogene regulation.
Yeah, their work is fantastic.
It is. Their research paper, which was published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences in June of 2026, provides the roadmap for this entire discussion.
Okay, let's unpack this. The factory manager we're talking about is a protein called C-Mike.
Right, C-Mike.
It's a master transcription factor. Its entire job is basically to bind to your DNA and read the instructions to make other proteins. And when it is overexpressed, it drives incredibly aggressive cancers like lung, breast, colon, leukemia.
Yeah, the big ones.
Exactly. And historically, C-Mike has been considered quote-unquote undruggable. But why is that? I mean, we have drugs for so many other proteins, right?
Yeah, we do. But that undruggability comes down to its physical structure. See, many proteins fold into very specific, rigid, three-dimensional shapes.
Right.
And because they're rigid, they have these little crevices and pockets on their surface.
Yeah.
So you can design a small chemical drug to fit perfectly into one of those pockets. Like
a key sliding into a lock.
Exactly. Like a key to a lock to just jam up the machinery.
Yeah.
But C-Mike is what we call an intrinsically disordered protein.
So it doesn't have a rigid shape. It's more like, I don't know, like a piece of wet string just constantly wiggling around.
Precisely. It's flexible. It's chaotic. And because it's constantly shifting, it doesn't have those stable pockets for a drug to bind to. I mean, you can't design a key if the lock is constantly changing shape.
That makes total sense. So if we can't drug the C-Mike engine directly from the outside, we're sort of forced to understand how the cell naturally regulates its speed from the inside.
Right. Because if the cell is constantly producing this chaotic, you know, wet string that wants to force the cell to divide, how does it avoid a total meltdown?
Yeah, there has to be an internal emergency break somewhere.
There is. And it involves something called post-translational modifications, or PTMs.
Okay, PTMs. Let's define that.
Think of a PTM as a chemical tag that gets added to a protein after it's already been built. The cell attaches these tiny chemical groups, like a phosphate group, or maybe a ubiquitin tag to specific amino acids on the protein chain.
So they act like tiny switches.
Exactly. They can change the protein's shape, or tell it to move to a different part of the cell, or, crucially, mark it for destruction in the cellular recycling center.
So we have these chemical tags trying to control the C-Mike engine. And one of the main regulators doing the tagging is this enzyme called SKP2.
Right. SKP2 is a ubiquitin ligase.
Right. And its job is to attach a ubiquitin tag to C-Mike, which, as you said, is basically the universal cellular signal for destroy this protein. But looking at the literature, SKP2 presents us with this wild biological paradox.
Oh, it truly is one of the most fascinating mechanisms in cellular biology. So SKP2 binds to C-Mike and tags it for destruction. But here's the crazy part. That very act of binding and tagging, that physical interaction, is actually required to stimulate C. Mike's cancer-driving activity in the first place.
Wait, let me make sure I'm picturing this right. The very thing that destroys C. Mike is also the thing that turns it on.
Yeah.
So SKP2 is essentially a gas pedal that burns out the engine. Like, it ramps C. Mike up to maximum speed, forces it to read the genes that cause cell division, and then immediately sends it to the shredder.
Exactly. It guarantees that C. Mike can only act in very short, powerful bursts. You get a spike of cell division signals, and then the signal is destroyed before it gets out of control.
Oh, I see. That's actually pretty brilliant.
It is, normally. But in many cancers, this balance is lost. The shredder can't keep up, and SKP2 actually acts as an oncoprotein itself. It's just constantly turning the key in the C-Mike ignition.
Which means the cell needs a secondary layer of control to stop SKP2 from constantly hitting the gas. And that leads to the core discovery from the Tulane team. They found a totally new post-translational modification acting on C-Mike called crotonylation.
Yeah, crotonylation, it's a specific form of acylation. Basically, it involves attaching a molecule called crotonate, which is a short-chain fatty acid, onto the protein.
Okay, but we knew about crotonylation before this, right?
We did, but historically we knew it happened on histones. Those are the spool-like proteins that your DNA wraps around to stay organized. Finding this fatty acid tag on a non-histone protein, especially a chaotic master oncogene like CMIT, that is a massive shift in our understanding.
Okay, but crotonate is tiny. I mean, it's just a few carbon atoms. How do researchers physically find a tiny fat molecule attached to a massive protein inside a living, messy cell?
Right, it's a needle in a haystack.
Hmm.
But the methodology here is incredibly elegant. The researchers started with human cancer cells, specifically HCT116 colon cancer cells and HEK293 embryonic kidney cells.
Okay.
They exposed these cells overnight to crotonate and actually see if the modification was happening. They used pan-crotonylation antibodies.
Antibodies, like what our immune system makes.
Exactly, but custom designed. They act like highly specific homing beacons. They're engineered to bind only to proteins that have a crotonite tag attached to them.
Oh, okay. So they use these antibodies to basically pull out the tagged proteins, and then they run them on a gel, and they can physically see a band indicating that, yes, C. amnulus has crotonate attached to it.
Yeah, exactly.
But wait. C-Mike is a chain of over 400 amino acids. Just knowing the tag is somewhere on the string doesn't really help us understand how it works. How do they pinpoint the exact location?
For that, they utilize high-resolution mass spectrometry, or HRMS.
Okay, I've heard of that. How does it work here?
Mass spectrometry essentially acts as a highly advanced molecular scale. They take the crotonylated C-Mike protein and use enzymes to chop it up into tiny, predictable fragments.
Like molecular scissors.
Right. Then they shoot those fragments through the mass spectrometer, which weighs them with extreme precision.
Oh, I get it. Because they know the exact mass of a normal C-Mike fragment, and they know the exact mass of a crotonate tag, so they're just looking for the fragment that weighs slightly more than it should.
Precisely. The HRMS reads the sequence of those heavy fragments and pinpoints exactly which amino acids are carrying that extra weight. And they found that crotonylation only happens on very specific amino acids called lysines.
Lysines, okay. But, you know, correlation isn't causation. Just knowing the fatty acid attaches to a lysine doesn't prove it acts as a brake on cancer.
No, it doesn't.
You have to physically remove the brake to see if the cell crashes, right?
That is exactly where they employed a classic molecular biology technique called PCR mutagenesis.
Okay, what is that?
They went into the genetic code for C-Mike and literally swapped out the instructions for those specific lysine amino acids, changing them to a different amino acid called arginine.
Why arginine? Why not just, I don't know, delete that section of the protein entirely?
Because if you delete a section, you risk completely destroying the overall three-dimensional behavior of the protein. The string might just collapse, which would ruin the experiment.
Oh, right. You'd break the whole thing.
Exactly. Arginine is the perfect molecular decoy. It's very similar to lysine in its physical size and its positive electrical charge.
So it behaves the same way in water.
Right. Swapping them doesn't fundamentally change how the wet string behaves. However, arginine lacks the specific chemical hook that the crotonate tag attaches to.
Ah. So by swapping lysine for arginine, you create a crotonylation deficient mutant.
Exactly. The cell physically cannot attach the crotonate brake to those spots anymore.
So the researchers create these unbreakable mutants. And I read they made an 8R mutant, where they swapped out 8 different lysines for arginines, and a 2R mutant, where they only swapped out 2 specific lysines.
Yes.
So what actually happens when you put these mutant proteins back into living cancer cells.
To measure that, they used incucyte proliferation assays and colony formation assays.
Let's break those down.
Sure. An incucyte system is essentially an incubator with a built-in automated microscope.
Oh, that's cool. So it's taking pictures constantly.
Right. It takes pictures of the living cells every few hours over several days. This allows researchers to calculate exactly how fast the cancer cells are dividing and multiplying.
And the colony formation assay.
That looks at the long term. Can single cancer cells survive and grow into large visible colonies over a couple of weeks? Both of these are direct measures of oncogenic power.
And the results were just explosive. I mean, the mass spectrometry originally found 10 different crotonylation sites on C. mite. But through this careful mutation process, the researchers narrowed it down to two critical linchpins, lysine 289 and lysine 298.
Right. When just those two specific sites, K289 and K298, cannot be crotonylated, the cancer cells gain a massive proliferative advantage.
Wow. Just two tiny spots.
Yeah. And it didn't matter if they used the 8R mutant or the highly targeted 2R mutant. The effect was exactly the same. The cells divided significantly faster in the incucyte. They formed significantly more colonies.
Did they check which genes were being activated?
They did. When they extracted the RNA to see what gene C. mite was turning on, they found specific genes responsible for cell division and survival were completely hyperactivated.
Okay, so removing the brake at just those two specific spots puts the cancer engine into overdrive. But I want to go back to our analogies. If C. mite is a chaotic wet string, how does attaching a tiny fat molecule to it actually stop it from driving cancer? Like, what is the physical mechanism there?
To answer that, the researchers turned to AlphaFold, which is an advanced artificial intelligence program.
Wait, the protein folding AI.
Exactly. You feed AlphaFold an amino acid sequence, and it predicts how those electrical charges and repulsions will cause the protein to crumple and fold in three-dimensional space.
And what did AlphaFold predict when it looked at C. mite with these crotonate fats attached to it?
It predicted a radical structural shift. The crotonylated C. mite becomes much more compact. It essentially loses a lot of its intrinsically disordered nature and folds up tightly.
Okay, let me guess. If the string crumples up into a tight ball, it physically hides the binding site for SKP2. The shredder can't get a grip to turn the ignition.
That is exactly the mechanism they elucidated. Crotonylation acts as a physical barrier. It changes the conformation of C. mite just enough to block SKP2 from binding.
Wow.
And remember this KP2 paradox we discussed earlier. SKP2 needs to bind to C. mite to license it, to activate that massive burst of transcriptional activity. If crotonate is attached, SKP2 can't bind. The gas pedal can't be pressed. The cancer genes stay quiet.
But if you look at the uncrotonylated C. mite-like R2R mutant, where the brake is removed and the string stays loose, does it bind to SKP2?
It binds incredibly strongly. And the researchers proved this through cohort immunoprecipitation assays.
Which is where you pull one protein out of a cellular soup and see what else is stuck to it, right?
Exactly. And the uncrotonylated C. mite pulled down significantly more SKP2. That strong binding ramps up the cancer activity to dangerous levels, while paradoxically decreasing the overall lifespan of the C. mite protein itself.
Because SKP2 is still tagging it for the shredder.
Right. The engine just does an incredible amount of damage before it gets shredded.
Man, this is where the paper moves from, you know, fascinating molecular biology to something with profound human implications. Because you might be listening to this thinking, okay, that's what happens when scientists engineer an artificial mutation in a petri dish. Does this matter for real patients?
Which is exactly what the researchers asked.
Right. They went looking through genomic databases of actual human cancer tumors, and they found a naturally occurring mutation at this exact spot, at lysine 298.
It's called the K298N mutation. In real human patients, the lysine at position 298 naturally mutated into a different amino acid called asparagine. And they found this specific mutation in primary human lung and breast tumors.
That is wild. The tumor itself figured out how to remove the brake to survive.
It's the ultimate chilling validation of the petri dish findings. And to prove just how dangerous this natural human mutation is, the researchers used an in vivo mouse xenograft model.
Let's explain what that is for the listener. A xenograft is a classic oncology model. You take mice that have been specially bred to have suppressed immune systems.
Yes, so they won't automatically reject foreign human tissue.
Right. And you inject human cancer cells into them to see how the tumor behaves in a living, breathing body with a circulatory system.
Exactly. So they injected these mice with human lung cancer cells. On one flank of the mouse, they injected cells with normal wild-type C. mite. On the other flank, they injected cells engineered to carry that natural human K298N mutation.
Okay, side by side, what happened?
After 4 weeks, the difference was staggering. The mice with the K298N mutant grew significantly larger, heavier tumors compared to the wild type.
Did they look at the tissue itself?
They did. When they examined the tumor tissue, the K298N tumors had drastically higher levels of a protein called Ki-67.
And Ki-67 is a key marker for cellular proliferation. It's basically a flag that cells wave only when they are actively dividing. So more Ki-67 means a much more aggressive tumor.
Exactly. They proved definitively that losing this single crotonylation site turbocharges tumor formation in living bodies. A single amino acid change, and the cancer just goes wild.
If we connect this back to you, the listener, the implications are just vast. Because we have to ask the most obvious question, where does crotonate actually come from? I mean, our bodies don't just magically summon complex fatty acids out of the void.
No, they don't. Crotonate is a metabolic intermediate, and one of its primary sources is actually our gut microbiota.
Wait, really? Our gut bacteria?
Yes. Specific strains of bacteria that live in your colon right now, like Acinetobacter fermentans and various Clostridia species. They generate crotonate as a byproduct when they ferment the dietary fiber you eat.
Hold on, let's trace this pipeline. Are you saying that I eat fiber for breakfast, the bacteria in my gut ferment it, they release crotonate, and that molecule somehow travels all the way to my lungs to act as a physical brake on one of the deadliest cancer proteins in existence?
I mean, that is the biological pipeline the data points toward. The crotonate produced in the gut can passively diffuse into your intestinal cells or be transported through the bloodstream.
That's incredible.
It gets better. Once inside a cell, an enzyme called ACSS2 grabs the crotonate and converts it into its active form, carotenyl-CoA.
Does our body make it on its own too?
It does.
Yeah.
It's also produced endogenously by your own cells as a byproduct of mitochondrial metabolism, specifically when your body breaks down fatty acids or amino acids.
Okay, so there are two sources.
Right, and the overall intracellular concentration of this carotenyl-CoA is the primary driver of how much crotonylation actually happens on proteins like c-myc.
This raises a massive, tantalizing question for the future of medicine. Could we one day alter a patient's diet, or, you know, give them a highly specific probiotic to purposefully increase the population of carotenate-producing bacteria in their gut?
It's a huge possibility.
Or could we design a therapy that stimulates that ACSS2 enzyme you mentioned to pump out more of these tags, effectively forcing the brakes onto c-myc and starving the tumor?
It is an incredibly promising therapeutic avenue, but as scientists, you know, we have to approach it with rigor and acknowledge the limitations of the current study.
Fair enough. What are the limitations?
Well, we have to remember that protein regulation is incredibly complex. When the researchers used PCR mutagenesis to substitute lysine for arginine, they proved that specific location is critical. However, lysine 289 and 298 exist in a region of c-myc that is heavily trafficked by other modifications.
Oh, I see. It's like a busy intersection. There's competition for that exact parking spot on the protein.
Exactly. Changing that lysine might accidentally block other PTM tags that normally attach to those exact same spots, like acetylation or sumoylation.
Ah, so the explosive cancer growth we observed with the 2R mutant might be partially due to the loss of those other regulatory tags as well, not just crotonate.
Precisely. Future research has to untangle these highly specific overlapping modifications to see exactly how much of the braking power belongs strictly to crotonate.
And we also need to find the cellular machinery actually doing the tagging, right?
Yes. We know ACSS2 provides the raw material, the carotenyl-CoA, but we do not yet know the specific enzymes, the carotenyl transferases, that physically pick up the tag and attach it to c-myc.
And what about taking it off?
Right, nor do we know the specific enzymes, the decrotonylases, that might remove it. Finding those specific transferase enzymes is the next great hurdle.
Why are those enzymes so important to find?
Because enzymes have rigid structures with defined active sites. They are historically much, much easier to target with small molecule drugs than disordered proteins like c-myc.
Oh, so if we can find the enzyme that attaches the carotenate brake, we can design a drug to hyperactivate that enzyme.
Exactly.
Speaking of druggability, there's actually a structural silver lining here regarding c-myc itself. We established earlier that c-myc is undruggable because it's a chaotic, wiggling, wet string.
Right.
But AlphaFold predicted that when c-myc is crotonylated, it folds into a more compact, rigid structure.
Yes, and that compaction could be a game changer. A compact, rigid structure often creates the stable pockets and crevices required for traditional small molecule drugs to bind.
Wait, really?
Yeah. It's entirely possible that by forcing c-myc into its crotonylated state, We don't just stop CK2 from binding, we might actually force C-Mike into a shape that finally has a keyhole, making the quote-unquote undruggable protein vulnerable to traditional pharmacology.
Man, it is just a brilliant intersection of metabolism, structural biology, and oncology.
It really is.
To distill everything we've covered today, crotonyl elation is a newly discovered chemical modification that acts as a vital physical brake on C-Mike, which is one of the most dangerous cancer-driving proteins in human biology.
Right.
It works by compacting the protein's chaotic structure, physically blocking its interaction with the co-activator SKP2. But when cancer cells naturally mutate to prevent this modification, as seen in real human lung and breast tumors, that brake is permanently removed and aggressive tumor growth goes into absolute overdrive.
What does this mean for the future of cancer treatment? And could the secret to suppressing our deadliest oncogenes be hiding right now in our own microbiome?
This episode was based on an open access article under the CC BY 4.0 license. You can find a direct link to the paper and the license in our episode description. If you enjoyed this, follow or subscribe in your podcast app and leave a 5-star rating. If you'd like to support our work, use the donation link in the description. Now stay with us for an original track created especially for this episode and inspired by the article you've just heard about. Thanks for listening and join us next time as we explore more science base by base.
Start to spark a switch on a protein in the dark, a tiny mark where the message is aligned, and suddenly the noise learns how to decline. Hands on the bench, eyes on the close. SKP2 pulls tight like a knot in a rope. The pages turn faster, the volume climbs, more genes lit up in relentless time. And there's a very signs, K29, K29.